The following program is to honor the memory of the missing in action and those who search for those MIAs around the world.
Live from the Veterans Radio Studio and Ave Maria Radio in Ann Arbor, Michigan, this is Veterans Radio. And now, here is your host, former CB, Gary Lilly.
And good morning to everybody out there around the world listening to Veterans Radio, whether live on the radio stations that we're broadcast on, and those who are listening over the internet. It's going to be a really interesting program today. We have Paul Schwimmer, who is a surveyor. Paul was on this program, Veterans Radio, January 16th, 2010. If you're so inclined afterwards, you can go to veteransradio.net and listen to that program, and I think you will, because this is very interesting. Paul is with an organization that's called the Bent Prop Society, and we're going to talk about what the Bent Prop Society is in a few minutes. And I am Gary Lilly, Chulai, Vietnam, Republic of 1966. In the booth with me is Paul Schwimmer. Good morning, Paul.
Good morning, Mr. Lilly.
And up there is Matt is on the control board. Good morning, Matt.
Good morning, Gary. Pleasure to be here.
And Kai is out there with you.
Yes, I'm here, and good morning.
Good morning, Kai.
Awesome.
You're running the camera and such. Is Dale Steele here? Did he leave?
No, Dale took off for the day. He said, good luck, Gary.
Yeah, thank you very much, Dale. He came in to do a few chores on about Veterans Radio and is now off to enjoy his Saturday. Hope you folks out there are all going to enjoy your Saturday and that this will be a good start for it. We're going to go straight into our welcome home. Every week on Veterans Radio, we welcome home the troops that are served our country overseas and are coming back, hopefully for good, if not for a good long stay. And from Veterans Radio to all of you, welcome home.
You have honorably served the United States and the Marine Corps in times of peace and war. Now we would like to serve you. The Marine Scholars Program covers the total cost of attending Ave Maria University. By combining resources from the Ave Maria University Marine Scholars Funding, federal financial aid entitlements, and the GI Bill. The benefits are granted for the duration of the recipient's study at Ave Maria University, contingent upon good conduct and good academic standing. The Marine Scholars Program is open to all reserve and active component Marines and other combat veterans of Operation Enduring Freedom and Operation Iraqi Freedom who have honorably served our country. Please visit us online at www.avemaria.edu or call the Assistant Director of Admissions at 239-280-2552. You helped us. Now let us help you. Semper Fi.
And we're back on Veterans Radio, and as I said, we've got Paul Schwimmer sitting with us. Paul is a registered land surveyor. I've known him in my commercial real estate. Paul's done some surveying for me, and he's really good at what he does and is using the new techniques. I don't think they're new anymore with GPS. It's not the old shooting with a stick
The old transit and tapes, which I cut my teeth on back in the 60s.
Did you use chains and links?
No.
That was before you?
Chains were before me, luckily.
And rods? No rods? Converting probably some of those old legal descriptions that had rods and chains and links.
Yeah, I've been surveying for 43 years now, and what I bring to the MIA recovery is my experience and ability to translate maps and information provided in World War II and bring it up to standards, today's coordinate system. So we've got a fair chance of finding these guys.
You've shown me some of it. We're going to be talking about how you do your job with the Bent Prop Society. But first, what is the Bent Prop Society? What does that society do?
Let me clarify. It's called the Bent Prop Project.
Project.
Nope, that's absolutely fine. The Bent Prop Project was started approximately 16 years ago by the founder, Dr. Scannon, out of California, and it focuses entirely on the island chain of the Republic of Palau. Palau, and for you Marines out there, remember the horrendous battle at Peleliu. Palau is about 500 miles north of New Guinea and maybe 500 miles east of the Philippines, down in the middle of the South Pacific.
How far apart is Palau and Peleliu, or is that all one and the same?
The island chain is the same. I can tell you how far it is. It's a 45-minute boat trip, and with the Palauan guides going about 35 miles an hour, crashing through the waves.
Okay. So Palau is an island, and Peleliu is an island in a particular chain of islands?
It's called the Republic of Palau, called the Rock Islands, the major island, if we want to go into names, the big island that's called Babeldaap. And the island that we stay on is Malakau, and then there's a Rakabazan and the island of Koortown.
What was this chain called during World War II?
Palau.
It was called Palau.
It was called Palau, and Peleliu was one of the most southern islands, and MacArthur felt it was necessary to take it so we could have the airstrip that was there.
And what would the airstrip be used for?
They were trying to make sure that the Japanese couldn't attack the American fleet as MacArthur went up to the Philippines.
All right. So we lost a lot of people on Palau and Peleliu.
Peleliu is where the Marines really cut their teeth. God bless those boys. Up in the Palau, this is where the Bent Prop Project is mainly going after the crashed aircraft that were destroyed. Approximately 200 aircraft were hit, 70 the team believes may have MIA POW remains on, and we chase these guys down in the jungle, and we chase them down in the sea.
How did the founder get started and with the Bent Prop Project? What got him interested in that, and why did he select Palau?
He was, when he was younger, he had volunteered for a team that searched for the Japanese merchant ship sunk by George Bush Sr. There was some political infighting where the opposing party said that he had sunk a unarmed ship, and so this team of scuba divers went. They recovered that ship. They found the gun stanchions on it and proved that that it was an armed combatant. And then when he was leaving, he found wreckage around the island and started asking the question, you know, where's that from? And nobody knew. Well, where's the pilot? Well, nobody knew that either. And he made a commitment, a very strong commitment from that point forward, to recover these kids.
And he organized a crew with different specialties, is that correct? Or?
That's correct. He started by himself, and then more team members came on, and then team members with specialties, scuba diving, jungle work. More than anything, just a deep, heartfelt passion that these kids, you know, have the God-given right to come home. And if, you know, we have women on the team, we have older gentlemen on the team, we have younger gentlemen on the team, but the drive is there. Bring them home.
Besides being a surveyor, you were special forces.
That's correct. Back in the 68 to 74, I spent 6 years in the reserves as a demolition specialist on a special forces A team. That's correct.
And you spent time in the jungle.
I've been in a lot of different jungles around the world.
So people would say, well, how can we lose 70 aircraft on an island?
The question is not how we can lose them. They were shot down. The question is how, you know, the ability to find them.
Well, that's what I mean. You know, they're shot down on an island. You ought to be able to walk right up to them, right?
Not in the jungle area that we're covering. Our main piece of evidence to find these aircraft were interviews with the elders, the Palauans that had come through the war. You have to realize that after the war, the United States military, through the Grave Registrations Unit, made it just a terrific effort to find these kids and locate the wreckage. And we have the records of those searches, and where they couldn't find them, we've been having some pretty good luck. You have to realize 60 years ago, the maps that they were using and the techniques they were using don't compare to what we have available to us today.
And the whole thing is, when you're in very, very thick jungle, you can't walk up on an airplane because you might not only be able to see 10 feet at times.
That's one of the biggest misconceptions. When we interview the local native population, we don't tell them that we're looking for an airplane because they won't understand. But if we tell them we're looking for aluminum, then they know exactly what we're looking for, because these aircraft are not sitting on the ground on their run, you know, on their landing gear. We're going to talk about one Corsair that we located last spring after a long search. That's the biggest piece is no bigger than your arm.
And it's amazing that you can find them, and with things going over the top of them, deterioration and all that, and a lot of times you're just looking for something that doesn't look right.
Doesn't look right. When we get into this young lieutenant, we'll explain the technique I used.
Okay, good. Now, there's a lot of research that goes into it. How is the target selected?
Half of the team, well, most of the team is assigned some type of research. We have a small number of very, very dedicated researchers that, you know, the amount of time that they spend at the National Archives is just absolutely phenomenal. You know, digging through cardboard boxes and material that have not been read in 65 years, and some of it has been misboxed. And then based on that information, we start to put a target plan together. The senior members of the team say, okay, we're going to go after this target, and then the research starts. We just do not go to these island groups and say, okay, we're going to look in the jungle here. You know, we have a detailed plan. When I volunteered to lead the land operation for this Corsair, all I can tell you is that I live and breathe finding these kids. Yep. And the computer time I put in, preparation of my map, when we got over there, we knew exactly what game plan we were going to use. And you're right. Trying to find something in the jungle, sometimes we were no more than 3 feet apart. You know, the name of the game was nothing bigger than a football gets between us.
We're going to get into what the mission is, but you showed me one time when you were searching for the graves of some Americans and a missionary, Australian missionary, I believe, that were executed and buried, that the Japanese that did it admitted to it during war crime trials and even drew a map of where the burial site was.
That's putting it generously. To start that story, a B-24 was shot down and over the town of Koor, and three kids got out and parachuted into the water. They were picked up by the Japanese at that time, and then they were taken through the island into the center of it, and later they were executed and buried. We found out, one of our researchers, Mr. Mark Swank, did the research on that and started to turn the war crime trial information over. And in that war crime trial were these hand-drawn sketches. And so when you said that there was a map to them, that's not quite true. It was like a big jigsaw puzzle, trailing those kids through the jungle based on these hand-drawn sketches until we finally came up to what we believe is the burial site for those three.
And how did you find that site? Using old maps,
bringing up and using the old maps, figuring out the sketches, and as a surveyor with over four decades, I'll be the first one to admit that I was really embarrassed that it took me a while to figure out that all the sketches had north pointing down instead of up. And as soon as you turn the sketches over, you can start to say, oh, now I see what they're doing. And once I figured that out, then you know it kind of got us onto the right trail. The team had been looking for those guys for a number of years.
And you use old aerial reconnaissance and combine that with Google Earth?
We use Google Earth. My whole goal is to be able to take 1944, 1945 aerial photography, overlay it on new technology, and which will allow me to rewalk the roads that were there at that time, the trails through the jungle that were there. You know, so if I can lay that photography over new information, we can retrace where the Japanese were.
And pretty much you have to bring them to the same scale, and then you have to bring the sketch to the same scale. And so you're more or less, you have three layers, do you?
More like five layers. You know, if you start with Google Earth on the bottom, uh-huh. which is a very nice application, but everybody has to remember that the Google Earth is measured along the curvature of the Earth, and surveying and the air photography is the flat, so you're trying to compensate to that. So I would take the Google Earth. I would then lay the 1944 U.S. military bombing map, that we call it, on top of that, and then I would lay the photography on top of that. And then I would start to lay the sketches on top of all of that. And with the computers, it gives you a good idea of, it aided the mission leader at that time to direct his search where he wanted to go.
What did you have that site narrowed down to?
Mark had it down to three sections of the jungle, and what finally ended up on that one is that on the most southern end of the jungle, that turned out to be where the execution site was. And then the second portion of jungle that he had searched was the actual burial site.
And you found the burial site, you believe?
We believe we have. We believe we have. And we can't really just go in too much because that information has been supplied to JPAC, which is the Joint POW-MIA Accounting Command, and we'll call it JPAC. That's the military people that have actually got the forensic and, you know, anthropologists to come in and do the recovery.
Okay. Now, this is the important part. You, as volunteers and independent citizens, will find a target. When you find that target, do you go digging around? Or?
Absolutely not.
Okay.
Now, we locate the target. We do not want to disturb any evidence. And our job is to find the target through research and through, you know, search in the field and recovery, preparation of a report strong enough that we can convince JPAC, the military, to come in and do a study. It's an expensive proposition for JPAC to come in and do these recoveries.
They're not inexpensive, and they're a lot of people assigned to it that are time-consuming?
It's time-consuming. JPAC is only about 400 people, I understand, and we're going to get into them a little bit farther, but they've got like 75 missions going on this year themselves. And, you know, for them to come down, we have to be pretty convincing that we've got who we're looking for.
Where are they searching? They're not all searching on Palau and Peleliu.
No, JPEC is, their current missions are worldwide right now. If I have this correctly, they're doing 75 investigations, and God bless all these kids and all these people at JPEC, you know, who are volunteers and are also paid to come in around the world. They're doing 33 missions in 14 countries. 43 teams are going to go to the Vietnam theater and recover our boys there. 12 are going to be working on the Korean War operations. And 21 are still supporting those of us looking for the World War II kids.
And we're going to get into specific missions, but you have some options coming up. What is it that you've been offered? You're kind of in demand right now, it seems.
Well,
like.
Not really in demand, but it's always exciting. There's a team that is currently going to be working, looking for downed aircraft in the Himalayas. They've got another project down on the marine landing in Guadalcanal. Their biggest success right now is on the island of Tarawa, and this gentleman's name is Mark Noah, who leads a organization called the History Flight. And to date, I believe Mark has recovered 219 Marines. And he feels that there's another 200 there, and it's no one's blame. During the invasion of Tarawa, there were so many casualties that they couldn't bury him individually, so they buried him in mass graves. Hopefully, Mark, I think I've got that right. And then after the war, they just misplaced or forgotten, or the people that did the burial were no longer there, and so these kids have been on Tarawa until Mark's organization is now helping JPAC retrieve them.
There were tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands, of American killed in action brought back after World War II.
There's 80,000 MIAs right now.
There's 80,000 MIAs on top of the... I read an account of it bringing back the KIAs right after World War II. That's an amazing, amazing job that they did, and just shows the dedication because it was not a pleasant job. Okay, let's get into the mission that you did that we talked about last year. Give us a couple of minutes on that. What did you do?
That was in 2009. That was my first year with the Bent Prop Project, and the main mission at that time was going after the three crew members that came out of the B-24. We revisited that site last March in 2010, freshened it up. The president of Palau, a very gracious President Johnson Torabong, was interested, and so we led a delegation of his office holders to the site, and then we're waiting for JPAC now to either approve or disapprove or get us on the schedule to come do that recovery. That was 2009.
2010, what was your mission?
2010, I'd heard about the team's previous searches for a Corsair that went down up in the western portion of the island of Babeldaob. They had searched for it three times previously, and I felt with the new evidence we had and with the mapping technology that I had at my availability that we should take another crack at that one. And I spent a good portion of a year planning for that, putting maps together, analyzing data, and then when we got to Palau, we finally did get a chance to hit the field. I remember the year before, in 2009, when Dr. Scannon took us up a road and pointed down to a section of jungle where he said that there's a Corsair down there somewhere. I remember looking at that jungle going, you know, I've seen thicker jungle. I've seen more mountainous jungle before, but I can't remember wind. This was just a horrific, you know, section of the island. And that's what we worked in. We went in every day. That was a three-week mission, I believe, and by the end of the second weekend, we were going through the jungle, and our guide, our native plowing guide, Joel Maldangasang, who's been on almost every mission, stopped and he looks and he goes, aluminum. And as it turns out, where we finally located that aircraft was almost halfway between where the Americans said it was in 1945 and where the Japanese said they had knocked it down. They were about 1,000 meters apart, but if you think of 1,000 meters in mountainous jungle, there was a wonderful job by Joe to find that. And then we started to search the area, and we have what we feel is his crash site. He hit the ground so hard that this is a single-engine Corsair, F4U Corsair, that the 50-caliber machine gun bullets, I'm not talking about the brass, I'm talking about the head of the bullets, were bent over at 90 degrees. That's how hard he hit the ground. The biggest piece we found there was one of the wing flaps, but the majority of the pieces are about the size of your arm or smaller.
When I was in the military as a Seabee, stationed back at Lemoore Naval Air Station, periodically a plane would go in on training, and I was told to drive a truck up to one site. It was up in the foothills, which are like we'd call mountains here. In fact, the last part of it up the side of the hill, they had to winch me up. There was a crew up there ahead of me picking up the pieces. They had to get them up because it was a farmer's grazing area, and cows couldn't step on this sharp metal. But I pictured what I thought was a crash site, and when I got up there, I saw these guys going along with those big canvas bags with a strap over the shoulder, you know, like you see pictures of people picking up papers in the park, and that's what they were doing, was picking up pieces, and it was, with that one, almost everything was about 3 inches in diameter, other than the engine, which started out at about 9 feet, was now about 3 feet long.
Yeah, there's not much left. And the other thing you have to think about is that unofficially, you know, based on my calculations, is that the jungle floor accumulates about about 1 inch per every 10 years. So over 6 decades, you know, the jungle floor through leaf accumulation has covered these parts by about 3 to 6 inches.
Sorry, I'm picturing it.
It's in my mind all the time.
I'll bet you.
So let me just finish up on that one, Gary.
Right.
As the land leader, I prepared a 35-page document giving all my supporting evidence, and then Dr. Scannon has touched that up and is in a position now to present that to JPAC, you know, for hopefully that they'll come in and recover that boy.
What I was thinking about was an intended task for civilians. They might think that this is a disorganized thing, the military, and somebody says, oh, we lost Joe over there. But after every mission, there's an after-action report written up by the wing leader or whatever. There were debriefing of pilots, and there were mission reports that were part of the record. I was reading one on the internet last night. It was about how PBY Catalina float plane picked up a pilot that had been downed and just offshore in the Japanese firing at them and what it was. But he did a very detailed explanation of what took place and what they were thinking and all that. And I think most after-action reports were probably brief, but there was a lot of them very detailed. And what you guys are doing is looking at after-action reports, trying to pick up clues.
The mission for this year, for 2011, is the team is actively going after the last B-24 that they haven't recovered yet. And in regards to the after-action report, I can tell you that as a surveyor, I'm taking those after-action reports, putting them on top of Google Earth, putting them on top of my 1944 information, and I am retracing the last flights of that plane. And to show you how intense, one of the after-action reports commented that that this B-24 was hit with its bomb bay doors open. So I started to plot the course over the bombing run, and then I put the word out to Faye and Jack Wisely, who run the local Pride and Honor flights, where they fly the World War II vets to Washington, D.C. for the day. And I said, Faye, I need to talk to a B-24 bombardier. And I will be just, you know, she called me back and she goes, here's the phone number. And a couple days later I called and he goes, I've been waiting for you. And he says, what do you want to know? And I go, I need to know when you open your doors and when you close the bomb bay doors, because that'll tighten down my search area. And he went back. It did not take him more than a minute to go back 65 years in his mind. And he talked about every bolt, every rivet. He talked about the bladders that they carried. And it was all there. And, you know, these guys care that we bring back their brothers. They really care. So that's how intent I get on my mapping to try to reconstruct and narrow down the search area.
It's astounding to me how much evidence is there. I don't think I'd be good at it, although it's fascinating to me. I'd be so far off track looking through these documents. It would take me forever because I would want to read every page that, you know.
Forever's not a long time when you're looking for them.
Tell us a little bit about JPEC when we've got about a minute left in this segment. Tell us about JPEC when you guys turn the evidence over to them. What do they do?
Yeah, JPEC is this is the military organization, and they're functioned out of Hawaii. There's more funding, I understand, now going to them. You know, the job that these guys do is just monumental. They are the forensic anthropologist, and through modern technology, the team had just recovered a B-24 a number of years ago, and it was JPEC that identified the eight kids in this B-24 that had been sitting in approximately 50 feet of water for 60 years. Just a phenomenal group of Americans doing that job.
And they use a lot of evidence, including DNA, including
clothing scraps, DNA, anything that they can do to bring these guys, to identify them positively and bring them back.
We're talking to Paul Schwimmer, who's a member of the Bent Project that's going back and looking for MIAs from World War II, and it's a fascinating story. We'll be right back.
The Medal of Honor is the highest award for valor in combat given a member of the Armed Forces of the United States. There have been over 3,400 recipients of the nation's highest award. This is one of them.
Chaplain Joseph O'Callaghan administered to the wounded and dying, led firefighting crews, and directed the jettisoning of live ammunition from his stricken ship. Details after this.
Why do I serve in the U.S. Navy?
For freedom.
Freedom of religion.
What America stands for.
Why do I serve in the U.S. Navy? For honor.
Everybody. And watch out for everybody.
Freedom to vote.
Democracy.
Freedom to go outside and play with my kids.
I joined the Navy to serve my country.
Every freedom that we have.
The right to raise our kids in peace.
My little brother.
My wife.
My kids.
Our children's children.
The United States Navy.
It's not for ourselves alone that we serve.
O'Callaghan was serving as chaplain on board the USS Franklin when that vessel was fiercely attacked by enemy Japanese aircraft. Calmly braving the barriers of fire and twisted metal to aid his men and his ship, O'Callaghan groped his way through smoke-filled quarters to the open flight deck and into the midst of violently exploding bombs, shells, rockets, and other armament. With a ship rocked by incessant explosions, with debris and fragments raining down and fires raging in ever-increasing fury, he ministered to the wounded and dying, comforting and encouraging men of all faiths. He organized and led firefighting crews into the blazing inferno on the flight deck. He directed the jettisoning of live ammunition and the flooding of the magazine. He manned a hose to cool hot armed bombs rolling dangerously on the listing deck, continuing his efforts despite searing, suffocating smoke which forced men to fall back gasping. O'Callaghan inspired the officers and men of the Franklin to fight heroically and with profound faith in the face of almost certain death and to return their stricken ship to port. The Medal of Honor series is a production of Veterans Radio.
And we're back on Veterans Radio. We're talking to Paul Schrimmer, a registered land surveyor who takes his skills to the Bent Prop Project and locates World War II, hopefully World War II remains missing in action by locating their aircraft in the jungle. A lot of research goes into it. That Corsair that you look for, there had been three previous missions that had not found it.
That's correct.
And what did you use that helped find at this time?
I was intrigued by the after action report. This young man, it was on December 1st, 1944. He was on a strafing run with his wing pilot, and he got hit by ground fire behind the cockpit. This is how detailed the information is. He got hit behind the cockpit, immediately burst into flames. The plane went turtle and then crashed into the jungle. A Corsair was the single engine fighter. It was the Corsair and the cat planes, the Wildcat Bearcats, that finally took the Japanese Zeros out of the air. And when he crashed into the jungle, then we had Japanese information that they had actually visited the site that day. They could not get close to the fuselage because it was burning and the ammunition was detonating off on it. So they waited till the next day. And we were surprised with new information to find that the Japanese had actually pulled the remains of the young lieutenant out of there and buried him close by. This was just all turned up from a new lead, a new map that we had recovered from one of the researchers that was looking in the Japanese military information. So I had always wondered why the U.S. grave registration people had not found him. And then when you look at their information, they said, we found the wreckage, we were shown the wreckage, but no pilot. Well, that's because they didn't know that the Japanese had visited the site and buried the pilot. So now when we found that information, all right, now we have a new active site because we know that there's an American boy there. And then that was the first piece of information. So I had the ability to take the American location and the Japanese location and put them on a map, and they're about 100 or 1,000 meters apart. And then came the job, and this is the interesting part of it as a surveyor, is that the American grave registration listed all the missing Americans by latitude and longitude. And my first question was, well, what did they use for a base map? Because you certainly can't take latitude and longitude from 1944 and bring it up to 2010. They had to have something to go by. And so we started the search for that military map. People, when I get excited, when I find something cool, and I start jumping down, I get all excited, people don't understand it, but to a surveyor, when you're in a Japanese museum on the island of Peleliu, and there on the wall is a tiny little piece of U.S. map with a legend on it, you know, and I'm excited because that's the map I'm looking for. You know, that's the one that has the 1944 coordinate system on it. We chased that map down, found it in the Bishop Museum in Hawaii. We purchased it, and now we had the base map that the coordinates were made on. We could pick that base map up, put it over on top of Google Earth, and now we had 1944 coordinates in real time. And once we had that bit of information, we could start to do a pretty good comprehensive search.
With GPS.
you have to realize that, first of all, you know, the handheld GPS that's available to everybody is only good to the accuracy of 3 to 10 meters. My land surveying GPS will measure the width of your little finger, but the GPS that everybody has in their vehicle, 3 to 10 meters. Then you put that GPS into a triple jungle canopy, and your 10 meters is good if you're lucky. You're probably closer to 20 meters, but that's closer than what the Americans had back in 1944, where they tried to say, okay, well, we're in this valley, and there's a mountaintop over there based on this old topography, and say, okay, well, he's here.
So it's a mystery. I mean, it's like solving...
It's a puzzle. You're taking pieces of a puzzle, and then you're doing a highly intensive search.
And the Japanese have their archives that we can get into?
No, it's not that easy, of course. Right. We have a team member in Japan. Dr. Scannon could talk about that more directly, but the map that they turned up turned out to be a map that after an American aircraft was downed, the Japanese put a red circle on this map, and we therefore call it the Red Circle Map. And based on that, we now have evidence that the Japanese say they destroyed an American aircraft. Grave registration says, okay, we looked here. So now we have two pieces of evidence that says, okay, let's look here.
Time is flying past. What happened, what was the program or the mission last February? This past February.
I just got back 3 weeks ago. We sent a four-man team down, a pre-team, if you will. And our task was to use highly sophisticated side-scan sonar to search the bottom of the Philippine Sea, which surrounds the islands of Palau, and to obtain as much accurate data as we could for the main team to come down in March. And if we had what we felt were good targets, then that team would dive on our targets. The side scan information, and I'm going to put a plug in right here, because Mr. John DeMills, who's an old Navy salvage diver, started this side scan sonar firm. He's over on the East Coast, and he graciously donated an $80,000 Marine Sonic C-Scan unit to the Vent Prop Project for our use in recovering these downed aircraft. The technology is phenomenal. It gives us actual eyes down on the sea bottom. In our side scanning effort, my boat probably covered 27 miles of a grid on the Philippine sea bottom, and you're mesmerized by what scans through on the screen. You're going 2.2, 2.4 knots per hour all day long, 10 hours a day, sitting on this boat, dragging this device behind you, but you're always looking at the screen, always waiting for something to pop up that says, okay, we've got something to dive on there.
If you look away, you might miss.
No, it goes by too slow. The thing you have to worry about is we were in 120 to 130 foot of water, and as scuba divers, you've only got 9 months bottom time. So you have to pinpoint these targets that, you know, the team wants to dive very accurately.
Was this just random scanning, or did you have something in mind when you did that scanning?
No, it's all pre-programmed. Same thing as every other mission. We knew the areas that we wanted to search, and we had two boats going this time and covering as much data. And then the data will be reviewed. It's being reviewed right now. And then the tentative targets we put on a list, and the team going down, you know, will hopefully dive. Well, it would be nice if they could dive on 30 of those targets. I think we have more. But and then if they don't find anything this time, we'll go back and scan some more.
Was there a particular aircraft that you were looking for, or number of aircraft?
This is the B-24. We're still looking for Lieutenant. If you haven't seen it already, we're not giving any names out. We're not allowed to release the names. It's a little frustrating to know that you've got this young lieutenant in the jungle in the Corsair, but you can't notify. That's JPEG's responsibility. They have
Certainly.
To do a positive identification, then they'll notify the family.
In fact, you guys are sworn or contracted or whatever.
Not contracted. It's just we don't do it.
You don't do it. Okay.
The code of honor, we just, you know, it's kept amongst the team in confidential reports.
I interviewed a doctor out of Texas. He wrote a book called Searching for the Lost Black Sheep, and he led up a team. he thought it'd be okay. He did his research. They'd go in there, they'd walk up to it. Took them 8 years, 8 missions, and they finally found it. And in the meantime, they found a whole lot of other ones.
Right.
Yep. And that was on the island where the black sheep were, the Espiritu Santo. It's called something different now. Okay. The B-24, there's 8 guys on it.
We believe there should be 8 remains left on that. According to the after-action report, 2 kids did get out of it. They parachuted down. They were picked up by the Japanese. The Japanese information says that they were transported to the Philippines. Based on the other information we found, we don't believe that that's quite accurate. But we pretty much lost track of those 2. And hopefully the Ben Prop will continue to look for research to say that those kids are somewhere on the island and they'll go after them.
And of course, you know, there's 80,000 MIAs from World War II, roughly. Most of them.
78,000 to 80,000 for World War II.
Yep, there's ships down deep, there's people that just disappeared.
Ships down deep, and you have to realize that if it gets above deeper than 120 feet, we're really not qualified to go deeper. So yeah. We're kind of limited on the areas that we can actually, you know, to do a recovery on.
Now, there was one recovery of 8 crew members on a B-24.
The team found that in 2006. I believe, maybe 2004, the United States Navy very graciously came in with a salvage ship, and they spent 3 years recovering 8 of the crew member on that B-24 bomber. They had searched for that B-24 bomber for 10 years. 10 consecutive years they searched for that bomber.
Ben Prop, not the Navy.
Ben Prop. They presented the report. The Navy came down and did the recovery. 8 were positively identified. That happened. It was a wonderful experience in Arlington National Cemetery, where those boys were finally interned at the end of last April.
And there were some old family members, old folks like brothers, sisters that were there.
The Bent Prop team was there. The military invited every one of them, the families. There were probably 200 people there. The caskets, there was 2 caskets. One gentleman was buried by himself. The remains of 7 other were buried in the other casket. There was a funeral home. The Rolling Thunder Motorcycle Group paid tribute. They stood guard out in front of the building, just extremely moving. And then at the Arlington Chapel itself, the chapel was full. And to me, Gary, it didn't matter if these boys had died a week ago or 65 years ago. The feelings, the stories told, the final rest.
We're listening to Paul Schwimmer, Bent Prop Project. We'll be right back.
Veterans, need help with your VA benefit claim? Then call Legal Help for Veterans right now at 800-693-4800. To ensure the best possible chance for success, our attorneys at Legal Help for Veterans are devoted to VA claim appeals, and they will forcefully present your particular case. So make that call today to Legal Help for Veterans at 800-693-4800 for your no-charge consultation.
You have honorably served the United States and the Marine Corps in times of peace and war. Now we would like to serve you. The Marine Scholars Program covers the total cost of attending Ave Maria University. By combining resources from the Ave Maria University Marine Scholars Funding, federal financial aid entitlements, and the GI Bill, the benefits are granted for the duration of the recipient's study at Ave Maria University, contingent upon good conduct and good academic standing. The Marine Scholars Program is open to all reserve and active component Marines and other combat veterans of Operation Enduring Freedom and Operation Iraqi Freedom who have honorably served our country. Please visit us online at www.avemaria.edu or call the Assistant Director of Admissions at 239-280-2552. You helped us. Now let us help you. Semper Fi.
And we're back on Veterans Radio, coming to you on WDEO Radio, the Ave Maria Radio Network, and over the internet at www.veterans.org. veteransradio.net, veterans with an S, radio.net. Talking to Paul Schwimmer of the Bent Prop Project, this is just a personal commitment. You guys do everything out of your own pocket. You're not getting paid. You're paying to do this, and you're taking time off of work. What is it that drives you to do it, Paul, and the others?
You know, I'm sitting here and I'm just flashing back to the missions that I've had the privilege to be on, and it's the giving back. And it's not an old guy thing, because I'm well over 60. Some of the team members, the current team members we have, are active duty Marine F-18 pilots. Let me explain to you. When we attended the ceremony at Arlington National Cemetery, and the event was being held in the chapel, my wife and I and my son were sitting there, and we had three open seats next to us. And I turned around, and these three elderly ladies came in, one older by far than the other two, and I figured it was a mother and two daughters. And I waved them over, and they sat next to me. And they had a hard time finding the place. But as I introduced myself, the older lady said, "We're here to represent Airman Family." And once again, I can't mention the name. And as I was shaking the hand of her daughter, I heard what she said, and then I turned and I looked at her, and she said, "Oh, we know that our uncle was not on the B-24 and that he was one of the three that parachuted out." She said, "But my uncle's mother, or my uncle's wife, who was my mother, refused to believe that he did not die in that crash, because she was terrified that if he had been captured by the Japanese, he would have been tortured, and she just didn't want to have that memory. So she has always told herself over 60 years that her brother died in the crash." I looked at the lady, and I said, "I can tell you with a very good degree of certainty that your uncle was not tortured, and I can tell you that I've been as close to his remains as I am sitting to you right now, if the gravesite that we have found proves out to be." And she put her hands over her chest, and she goes, "I can't tell you what a relief that is going to be to my family." This is 65 years after. Some of the hometowns that received these World War II veterans, they lined the streets with flags, honoring these boys after 65 years. And not just one town, but a number of towns. It's the closure. For me, it's feeling them, it's hearing them, it's talking to them, it's searching for them. I don't pray a lot, as much as I should, but when I'm deep in the jungle and I'm frustrated and I'm hot and I'm tired, you know, I'll sit there and I'll pray. And I'm not going to tell you it happens every time, but, you know, usually pretty soon after that we get a pretty good sign.
You said before the program, we are broadcasting on Catholic radio, you said, "I believe in God." And when you prayed one time in the jungle, and the next day you found
it. It was hot. We were looking for our Corsair. It was muggy down there. I was sitting on the ground, and at that time I was smoking, and I was flicking the ticks off my pant legs that were crawling up my pant legs. And I just looked at the beauty of the jungle. You know, I wasn't mad. I wasn't. It was beautiful in there. And I just started saying, you know, the Lord's Prayer, things that I, you know, hadn't done for years. And just, I was at peace. And then it was the next day that we were in a little different section, and that's where we came across the aluminum. It's that kind of emotion that, you know, that every one of the team members has that brings into the field, you know, to do these type of recoveries. It's the closure, you know. Every American that fights for this country, you know, has the God-given expectation that somebody is going to bring them home.
That's one thing I am so fiercely proud of with the Vietnam generation, as the POW-MIA issue is one that came to the forefront, and our guys said, "We're not leaving them behind." Now, every generation has said that out on the battlefield, but it's our generation that said, "We're going to find the MIAs, and we're going to bring them back."
The first mission I went on, I carried the Saline, Michigan American Legion MIA flag. I asked permission. We went right out to the flagpole. We pulled it down. I folded it up, put it in my backpack, and that went through the jungle. I dove on the B-24 with it, and then I brought it back mud-stained and wet, and we framed it, and that's hanging in the American Legion. Let me just say that when we found the Corsair, I had the American flag that had been flown over Afghanistan in my pack that someone wanted me to carry. And every time the team recovers, makes a recovery, there's an extremely solemn flag-folding ceremony over the crash site. And that flag is held, and the videotape that is made of that ceremony is held until JPAC notifies the family, and then the surprise package comes of this folded American flag and the video telling how their loved one was found.
That is just tremendous. That is stupendous, and that comes out of the heart. It doesn't come out of any other reward. The reward
comes out of the heart. When I go there, when I'm privileged to go there, I have tunnel vision. You know, I may be way out of line, way too focused, way, but that's the way I get. When I'm looking for these kids, I'm hunting.
You know, it's a funny thing what you made me think of. You know, I said the Vietnam generation is so focused on MIAs. I used to backpack, and I had a POW MIA patch about 8 by 10 inches sewn on the back of my backpack.
Everybody should have one.
Yeah. What's coming up?
The team is leaving this coming next Saturday. They're going to be there for 4 weeks. The whole team won't be there, you know, team members, as it's all volunteer, so you go when you can. The team will be forming. They have some land targets that they have signed up ready to go. They're going to be diving on the hopefully on the information that that we recovered in the first 2 weeks of February, and hopefully that they're going to have success. And they'll document what they find. They'll document. They'll start the process again, and then start to talk about targets for the 2012. They're going to be doing that, and I'm going to start looking at is doing some surveying mapping for the history flight group over in the Ardennes area in World War II on the European continent. I think that I have some services that we can use to create maps that will help them do their location too.
And on this upcoming mission that they're going on, you're not going on it with the
Bed Pop? No, I did the 2 week prior mission, and the team that they have now, I don't think they need me on that team.
Will they have a surveyor?
No.
Well, you've got everything prepared from that you can from your end?
They've got the GPS techniques, and they've been doing this for a number of years.
Yeah.
All my focus this year was working on the side scan effort, and that's where my focus was this year.
You have to be a bit rugged to be doing the stuff, for 60, what?
I've got this big smile on my face because I'm turning 62 when the team leaves next Saturday. Every morning I'm down in the treadmill. I hate it. You know, at my age, at the last mission in February, I was leaning over the side of the boat working on the side, and I rolled a rib that's not healing up right, so I can't do sit-ups, but it doesn't matter. You know, in the morning I'm up, and I'm down there, and I'm working out. And, I've got 43 years of field experience land surveying, and I've probably got that much, if not more, hunting and tracking animals. And for me, that's just a plus of what I can offer.
You know the outdoors.
I know the outdoors.
You know what you're doing
that's
when you get off the
sidewalk. The outdoors is my office.
And there's no street numbers hanging out in the jungle.
Absolutely not. But there's trails, and I can follow them.
That's it's great. Paul, I want to thank you very much for being on Veterans Radio, and I envy the heck out of you. I wish I could do it. For various reasons, I can't do it, but I envy you for being able to do it. That's something I would just love to do, is go out there and do that same kind of work. I'll be turning 70 in a couple of months, but I still feel pretty good. My body. I used to tell you have to show your body who's boss. Well, it's
oh, really?
Time. I would show it who's boss. And
now mine's taking control.
Right. Next week, we're going to be, Dale Throneberry is going to have on Jay Wirtz, who's done a 10-volume set on the Pacific. They're going to be talking about Volume 1 next week, Pearl Harbor to Guadalcanal. And there's a pretty good hunting, I would imagine, not to be facetious, but out in Guadalcanal, I imagine there's still some MIAs out there, too.
Yeah, there may be teams there. Our team is just focused on the plow. And then before I get off, I just want to tell people that if you have MIAs, if you have uncles, we want you to know that we're still looking.
And with that, you've been listening to Veterans Radio, and you are dismissed.
Not all views and opinions expressed on Veterans Radio reflect the views of Veterans Radio or your local station. Veterans Radio is a production of Veterans Radio, LLC.
Veterans, need help with your VA benefit claim? Then call Legal Help for Veterans right now at 800-693-4800. To ensure the best possible chance for success, our attorneys at Legal Help for Veterans are devoted to VA claim appeals, and they will forcefully present your particular case. So make that call today to Legal Help for Veterans at 800-693-4800 for your no-charge consultation.